This is Boston Public Radio. Is it possible for fiction to surpass real life when it comes to Valerie Plame, the CIA agent whose cover was famously blown during the Bush administration? She makes the case that it can. Her novel, Blowback, is an international spy thriller detailing the work of fictional operative Vanessa Pearson. And if everything you know about DC you've learned from House of Cards, the truth could be, well, just as bad. Journalist Mark Leibovitz joins us to talk about his latest book, This Town. From there, Chris Matthews remembers a time when DC wasn't bogged down by partisan bickering. And if you think money can buy happiness, it could. That is, if you spend it in the right way. Behavioral economist Michael Norton joins us for that conversation and more next on Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. Today we're bringing you a collection of author interviews. We're kicking things off with former CIA operative Valerie Plame. She dropped by earlier this year when she was in town for the Boston Book Festival. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Is it possible for fiction to surpass real life when it comes to Valerie Plame? She, of course, is the CIA agent whose cover was famously blown during the Bush administration. Joining us in Studio 3 to make the case that it can is Valerie Plame. She's in town to talk about her debut novel. It's called Blowback. She co-wrote it with suspense writer Sarah Lovett. It's set to be the first in a series of international spy thrillers detailing the work of fictional operative Vanessa Pearson. Valerie, and I think Vanessa, welcome to Boston Public Radio. Look at the smile on her face. Obviously, I'm right.
Well, thank you for having me.
No, we'll just double check that because, you know, I'm looking across the studio at you, and you are indeed blonde. You are lithe, and you are elegant and have an understated sexiness going on there. So are you the character? I can say that because I'm the other woman in the room. Are you the main character in Blowback?
Certainly, Vanessa Pearson is informed by my experiences with the CIA, I would say. But I just got so tired of that whole genre, how females are portrayed in operations. They're usually just afterthoughts, or they're props, or they're just cardboard characters. And I wanted to develop a character that had real depth to her and was much more realistic and didn't just rely on guns and sex. Too.
Well,
although that's, you know, guns and sex
guns
are great.
Guns and sex are always fine. They're always fine. We'll talk about the book in a second because that's why you're here, obviously. But I'm dying to know. I mean, I read about you and you were recruited when you were at Penn State. And I'm dying to know, because you recruited people yourself later on working for the CIA. Why did they pick you, or how did that happen?
I can't go into details of that because the agency has made has laid down the law that I am not permitted to acknowledge my agency affiliation prior to 2002.
Okay.
But what I can say, I think, is that I come from a family where public service was considered to be something worthwhile. My father fought in World War II in the South Pacific. He was an Air Force officer. My brother served and was wounded in Vietnam as a Marine. My mother was a public school teacher.
Oh, wow.
So when I was given this opportunity, I really jumped at it because it seemed like it was a lot more interesting than what my friends were doing.
And are there many women, I mean, without, I think of CIA operatives, and this is probably very sexist of me, as men.
No.
I don't think of that, but there are apparently quite a few women.
Well, to my point exactly, the women that are in popular culture and espionage are just pretty forgettable, except for maybe some of their names of, you know, in the Bond series. But it is still an old boys network in many ways. Just like many organizations in America, there are still obstacles. But I tried to make my success in the CIA going after areas where I could make a difference and I could push forward. And that happened to me, for me to be in pursuing nuclear proliferation.
You know, well, I'm listening to you saying to Marjorie what you do, I'm saying, well, the role models we have, other than you, and I think people would put you in this category, there's obviously Homeland and Claire Danes. There's Jessica Chastain and Zero Dark 30, which does
40,
give you...
wasn't it? 40s?
It was 30, 30.
30.
It does give you
Sorry.
A different... Is that a fairly real depiction, either of them? Or you're smiling again in an odd way?
Neither are? I enjoy Claire Danes. She's a great
brilliant
actress. And the first season of Homeland was absolutely
brilliant,
riveting.
I agree.
But come on, she is manic depressive. And notice that she doesn't have any friends. Mm-hmm. I mean, when your business in human intelligence is to have a really good sense of those around you and to be able to spot, assess, develop, and recruit, which is really the core of what you need to do to collect intelligence, and your only friend is your jazz collection, it's just not, which, again, great TV. It's just not terribly realistic. And from what I understand, with Zero Dark Thirty, again, Jessica Chastain, terrific actress. She was nominated for the role. But that character really was a compilation of several. And furthermore, I know how the movie, because it's so much more dramatic, made it sound, you know, she was the only one on the case. And in fact, that's not true. There's dozens of people for many years that led to the ultimate takedown of Osama bin Laden.
We're talking to Valerie Plame. Obviously, you know her one way. You'll now know her as the co-author of a great new novel. It's called Blowback. You mentioned friends, Valerie, a minute ago. And, you know, all of us who are spy watchers, as opposed to being in spy agencies, saying, what is it like to have to lie to the whole world around you? You said a minute ago to Margie, I can't tell you how I whatever. Yeah, and you can't tell people what you do when you're doing covert stuff. How hard is it to integrate that into your everyday life with people who are close to you, who care about you?
Well, a couple things. First, the CIA recruits people that I think, for the most part, are really mentally strong and have certain characteristics that allow them to maneuver through that world. There is an incredible amount of training that goes into it. But really, it's when you get out there and you're in the field, your cover and your life are very intertwined. It's not one and the other. And personally, I never felt any guilt whatsoever about not being able to tell my friends or whomever where I worked, because a secret is a burden. And why do you want to burden people with that? There's...
But you're carrying the burden. You carry the secret.
And that's okay. I loved my job. I was really proud to serve my country. I worked on really interesting things. And that was simply part of the cost of it. Okay.
Yeah. Well, if people don't know this, because this has been written about extensively, and you've written about it too, you spent a lot of the time in the early 2000s looking for the elusive weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Mm-hmm. So... And you've written about this, too, that had you had more time, maybe we would not have gone into Iraq.
Exactly. There was clearly a push, and we can have a whole other conversation about what the factors were at play, whether it was a neoconservative ideology and they were an ascendancy, a certain feeling of trying to shore up executive power and so forth. But anyway, my job in the run-up to the war with Iraq was just that, operations, trying to get to the heart of the presumed Iraqi WMD program. Who were the scientists that were really key players? How were they procuring their material? How were they paying for it? What was the state of their nuclear program?
And a lot of these people were cooking the books that initially...
On which side?
Well, a lot of these people that were saying there were weapons turned out to be exaggerating the situation dramatically.
It's very complex, and you saw definitely a cascade of issues that led to us going to war. But I think it is fair to say that essentially Saddam Hussein took a look around his neighborhood, pretty rough, and realized that he wanted to be the biggest, meanest, baddest dog on the street. And the best way to say is, I have nuclear weapons. And we called his bluff.
So how upsetting to you was it to see the night of shock and awe when we did go over there?
It was deeply upsetting, because I knew from my work, I wasn't privy to everything, but the intelligence was really thin about having... we were told by the Bush administration that the nuclear threat was imminent. We don't want to see the smoking gun in the shape of a mushroom cloud. And I thought that we had moved toward military action with such rapidity that it takes a while to gather real intelligence. And taking a look at then Secretary of State Colin Powell's speech before the UN, where essentially he made the case for war, knowing that his case was much more robust than what I experienced, it was sort of, for me, cognitive dissonance. So I thought we failed. I thought we really failed in terms that if there was WMD and we're going in, we don't know where it is and we don't know how to protect our troops.
You know, it's pretty clear. You said how much you loved your job. It's pretty clear how much you value public service. Talk about your family, that sort of thing. As you walked into the room, Valerie Plame, we just finished a discussion about the shutdown. What's your I'm laughing at the expression on her face. What's your reaction in the last 16 days?
Like every American, I am absolutely appalled. I want an apology.
From whom?
Everyone involved. $24 billion. You might as well just take a lighter and, you know, have a nice little bonfire with that. It would take a while to burn that much. But
that's the alleged loss to the economy over the
yes.
last 16 days, according to Standard & Poor's.
No, I believe deeply in the good that government can do and in public service. And I always encourage young people to consider a career in public service. But when you send your representative to Congress, in fact, to govern, to solve problems and to make it a little better rather than harder, and they don't manage to do that, I haven't heard yet any sort of chagrin from any of our, very few of our elected officials that were involved in this debacle.
The equivalent of that apology you're talking about.
Or just, we're sorry it turned out so badly.
That's Valerie Plame. You know her from her history, but you will also know her based upon her new book. It's a novel. It's called Blowback, and she's at the Boston Book Festival.
Can I get back to something you were talking about before, that when people go look in general for people that might be able to do the kind of work that you did, they're looking mm-hmm. at people that are very mentally stable. what else, in general, what makes a good CIA agent?
I think one of the most important characteristics has to be a genuine curiosity about yeah. other people in the world around you. Everyone has a story, and you just need to find out what that story is. So I think that's important. And as I found out, common sense is actually not that common. An ability to think ahead
How about fearlessness? That hasn't been on your list so far.
Hey, you know, I'm the mother of 13-year-old twins. That is fearlessness.
You know? No, I'm serious.
way harder than anything else.
But you're
else
being
I had to
falsely
do.
Modest. I mean, that is obviously a huge.
I wouldn't say that adrenaline, some people, he's an adrenaline junkie. That's not what it, is it. But I certainly knew growing up that corporate America was never appealing to me. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I thought it had something to do with being overseas and doing something beyond the world I knew.
Do your 13-year-old twins think it's cool that mommy was a spy?
I guess so, but generally they're basically, as children are, really unimpressed by their parents
okay.
in general, which is why, I have some scrapbooks. So one day when they're more lucid, I can go, see, I actually, did some cool stuff.
Valerie Plame, before we get to your book, and we're going to do that in a couple of minutes, let me ask you about a couple of people and just a very quick reaction. Let's start in the current. The current head of the CIA, John Brennan, is mm-hmm. that, what's your take on John Brennan?
Well, he was very much engaged in what we now, enhanced interrogation techniques and so forth. He really is an insider's insider. I've no doubt that he cares deeply about this country, but I was just
What's
speaking.
What's the hesitation you see?
The hesitation is as we, the intelligence world has gotten so vast after 9/11, and I'll lump NSA revelations into that as well. There is no one person that can get their arms around it and really
understand.
Is it
understand. Too big? I mean, my second yes. name was Edward Snowden, so feel
yeah.
free to.
No, it is too big. I was in Washington, D.C. not too long ago, and every time I go, a couple times a year now, I don't live there anymore, but it is booming. The town is booming. The cranes on the sky, the new model cars, the restaurants are full. And this is because, and it's the contractors, billions and billions of dollars that have come into Washington in particular since 9/11. And when you have 60 to 70%, which is estimated, of the intelligence budget going toward contractors, something is seriously amiss.
Has the intelligence community, whether it's NSA or related, have they crossed the line between protecting us and invading our privacy?
In my mind, yes, particularly as these revelations come out every week and we understand more and more. There always is and will be an appropriate tension between security and privacy. But thus far, what I'm hearing our political leaders say, and a lot of self-important senators say, don't worry. Trust us. We are keeping you safe. And now we know that vast amounts of information that are being vacuumed up by NSA, they have lied to the public on almost every occasion possible when this has been discussed. And I am in complete agreement with President Obama, who said we must have a conversation about this. Yes, we must. And we wouldn't be having that conversation if it were not for Snowden. I think a lot of people expect me to say, oh, that was terrible what he did, and sources and methods being compromised. I can't speak to that. I don't know what nevertheless, this conversation, the issue, Snowden is not important. What is important is the issue.
One last name, Dick Cheney.
Yes.
So, I mean, give me a cliff. Give me a one sentence
something,
or two on Dick Cheney.
Well, how about I give you something on his daughter, Liz Cheney, who's running for a Senate seat in Wyoming.
In Wyoming,
I really am watching that with a little smile on my face, because she has spent her entire adult life in Washington. She's moved to Wyoming a year ago and is going after a sitting and established and apparently well-liked Republican senator.
And a family
senator.
Friend, by the way, a friend of the Cheney
is that an oxymoron, family friend in the Cheney family? But in any case, she's stepped on every banana peel out there, and I think they should just put up bumper stickers, Liz Cheney, as nice as ever.
That's very good.
That's a good enough answer to the Dick Cheney question. We're talking to Valerie Plame.
Yes, you were very much dissed during this whole thing when the cover was blown and so forth, and people were calling you a desk jockey and an mm-hmm. analyst, and that must have been
the amount of misogyny was quite astonishing. I mean, it was sort of like, oh, she's just a girl.
Exactly.
How could she possibly be doing operations? Sure. And it was, again, the media chose to focus on and the ambassador and his blonde CIA wife rather than the issue.
We're talking about
Joe
Wilson, by the way.
Joe Wilson is the husband, the ambassador, and the love of my life. But the issue should have been, is this really in our best national security interest to go to war with Iraq? And what's going to happen the day after? The whole war 10 years on was really just an ideological fantasy in an attempt to extend our military empire and remake the map of the Middle East. And it was an abject failure.
What do you think about our still being in Afghanistan?
You know, if my son or daughter were serving there, I would be so hard-pressed to understand. I initially, when we first went in, it was, I believe, an appropriate response because that's where the Taliban was.
Yeah.
They were actually the people that attacked us on 9/11, not Iraq. But it is just so painful to see it continue to unfold. And as we read of every week those that are lost there, you go, why?
Can I ask one last thing before
sure.
we get back to the book?
I
just wonder, you have written that it, had your cover not been blown, you would have liked to have continued with the agency
sure.
and gone back in.
Yes.
So what is the career span? Can you stay as an undercover agent till you're 65 and retire with your pension? Or is there a life?
Margie wants to know if it's too late for her. So, I mean, everything is about
well,
Margie.
Not me. Oh. I am a big chicken. Forget about it. But I mean, I just wondered if you can stay your whole career.
Yeah, my hope was, if none of this had happened, that I would retire as a senior intelligence officer. What happens is, as you go up in seniority, you manage more. Maybe you're not on the street as
right.
much, that sort of thing. But, that was absolutely the plan with my husband and I to go back overseas. And then this sort of all blew up. And I guess there's an unwritten rule that you can't leave Washington until the scandal is over. So that's why it took us a while to move out to New Mexico, where we are now. But obviously my career as a covert operative was done.
Yeah.
You never bumped into Walter White in New Mexico, did you? I just want to be clear.
Can I say I bumped into Bryan Cranston?
How exciting was
yeah,
that?
Yeah, fabulous. What Breaking Bad has brought to New Mexico and Albuquerque in terms of its economics.
Huge.
Huge. And Bryan is wonderful.
We all agree. So let's talk about Vanessa Pearson for a minute, Valerie Plame. What's the deal with the book?
The deal is this. It's the first in a It's a spy thriller, the first and hopefully a long series. Vanessa Pearson will continue showing up again. She's a non-official cover officer, meaning that she has no overt affiliation with the U.S. government. And it's wrapped around, the first book anyway, wrapped around a secret Iranian nuclear facility, which as we speak, we know talks are going on in Geneva on this very issue. And as I said, I tried to make it much more realistic in terms of tradecraft, how it really works, places where she shows up in the book are places I've lived or worked and traveled through. I know them well.
Did you have to submit this manuscript to the CIA?
Did.
You do?
I
because
did.
Of your life?
Yeah.
Everything you've written, you've had to submit, have you not?
I do.
Yeah.
I guess if I do a cookbook.
Yeah.
So did they...
The CIA cookbook, that'd
be
good.
Did they request or mandate that any part of this manuscript be...
It's all about protecting sources and methods, and I completely appreciate that and understand that. So while I submitted it in accordance to the regulations, they did not take exception to anything. They understood that this was fiction. But having said that, I tried to make it realistic.
So you're going to play her in the movie or what?
I've been so busy. This has just come out 2 weeks ago, and it's gotten some really nice reviews. So I've been so busy just getting that off the ground. So if you know anyone in Hollywood, just put in a good word for me.
Well, the movie made about you and your husband, Naomi Watts and Sean Penn, were the stars. That was a terrific movie.
Thank you. Fair game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They did a great job.
We were proud of it. And it told the story of what happened.
We were speaking with former CIA operative Valerie Plame about her debut novel, Blowback. When we come back, we're going to continue our author interviews with New York Times national correspondent Mark Leibovich. We'll get his take on the dysfunction and insularity of Washington, D.C. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're playing a collection of author interviews. Earlier this year, Marjorie and Emily Rooney sat down with Mark Leibovich to discuss his behind-the-scenes look at Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Mark Leibovich is the chief national correspondent at the New York Times Magazine. And if everything you've learned about D.C. is from The West Wing or House of Cards, you need to stick around for this conversation. His new book is This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, plus plenty of valet parking in America's gilded capital. Mark, thanks for joining us. No one it was quite as clever as that woman we just talked about, that commandeering her own valet parking spot. I didn't see any of those stories in there.
There could have been. Should have looked. I could have. I'd forgotten about the fire hydrant story, though, because that's sort of kind of Washington-esque. Uh-huh. You could probably have that happen in Georgetown. That's a great story.
So I have to say, after reading this whole thing, and I really felt like, first of all, you brought me there, and I was one of you, and I was like right in the room, and suddenly I realized why this is so much fun. It's like you're a power player. You're just in the mix. You're somebody. You're important. It's like,
yeah, but you don't even have to live there too. You get to come home to Boston at the end.
But I can see why it's so infectious.
Well, thanks. First of all, I mean it's been kind of cool because I mean I am an insider. Look,
I admit it.
I work for a major news organization. I mean I'm invited to these parties. I mean, my job is probably invited to these parties. I don't think me personally am invited to these parties, but. Yeah, I mean, this is the world I live in. I mean, I couldn't sort of pose as a foreign correspondent and just sort of like swoop in and burn down the village and leave. So, yeah, but I mean, having said that, you can't live in Washington, especially as a reporter, without having a more of a hate relationship with the place because you get so cynical and people talk to you in a certain way, and it's easy to forget that this is not reality. I mean, it's Hollywood in some ways. House of Cards is the thing that people have been talking about a lot lately. But this is not the way most Americans deal with each other. And this book was sort of an effort to bring that to life.
You start with the scenario of the Tim Russert funeral. And the power brokers coming into the Kennedy Center and the funeral. It was one ceremony after another, and coverage on TV, by the way, that went for a week.
Oh, yeah.
But how people were, you know, jockeying for the best seat in the house or to... I found it almost impossible to believe that they were handing each other their cards.
Business cards.
Business cards.
Oh, yeah, no. They were they were trying to... There was this great scene at that funeral, which happened sort of in June of 08, which was right after Obama was about to get...
Hillary dropped out.
Barack Obama was about to, you know, get nominated. McCain was about to get nominated. Everyone was sort of... There was a receiving line around David Axelrod and Robert Gibbs. Basically, everyone congratulating him, and I'm putting up bunny ears here. But they were trying to book Obama on their shows. They were trying to get in with what could be the next White House communications team. It was quite striking, not to mention everyone sort of competing for Tim Russert's job at his memorial service.
David Gregory.
How do you compete for the job at the memorial service?
Well, all the executives are there, and you go and you talk to them, and you grieve properly, and you grieve publicly. And there is a whole kabuki to it, which... Perhaps cynically, as some have accused me of, I try to describe. But no, that was a pageant. I mean, it was live television. It was, like you said, for days. And it was very much a state funeral. I mean, deservedly so. I mean, Tim Russert was a giant. And there are very few people who live up to his legend. And I think Tim was someone who got close. I think that the days of coverage probably didn't do it total justice, but whatever.
Well, while we're at this scene of the Tim Russert funeral, you talk about Bill and Hillary Clinton arriving, and I naively said, because I've not been in Washington, so this was an eye-opener to me, and I was a little bit, I don't know, it didn't feel right to me. Right. But anyway, you talk about Bill and Hillary Clinton coming in, and they had, you know, she just lost.
Right.
I want, and that they hated Russert, and Russert hated them. So I thought to myself, isn't there some level, like maybe when you've been elected president twice in a row and everybody loves you and she didn't win, but she's a huge celebrity, isn't there some point where you can say, you know what, I'm not going to be this big of a hypocrite because I've attained a certain stature. I'm always going to be a two-term president. Why do they have to go to this and pretend?
Well, I mean, first of all, the psyche of Bill Clinton has been the subject of all kinds of books and speculation and so forth. But I would say that, I mean, the comparison I draw in the book is to a mafia funeral.
Yes.
I mean, you have all the families coming together to pay respect.
Yeah.
You have the Democrats, the Republicans, the media, the hostile media, the friendly media, the money people, the hangers-on. And that was very much what that scene was like. And the Clintons are head of the Clinton family, and their tribe was just vanquished. And, you know, the Clintons are pros at death and sickness. I mean, that's what they do. Not to, again, be overly cynical, because I think that their empathy has served them well. And but no, I thought it was one of the striking parts of the scene.
You talk about 1992 with Bill Clinton, with kind of that was the birth of celebrity operatives. If Watergate was the birth of celebrity journalists, Woodward and Bernstein, but suddenly you had people like Mary Madeline and James Carville and George Stephanopoulos bursting on. Now many of these people, like David Axelrod, David Plouffe, these people are as well known. And they get the seats on Meet the Press and all those places. How did that happen?
Well, you're right. I mean, first of all, I mean, I think, one, I mean, the birth of cable, or really the boom in cable in the early 90s, sort of gave everyone a face. And it created a marketplace that didn't exist before for just people getting these big TV deals and commentator deals and so forth. That happened in conjunction with the book market sort of taking off for public servants becoming public brands, essentially. I mean, writing books, being, you know, made for TV, biopic characters, just the whole celebrity aspect of politics really taking hold, which has only been exacerbated with the internet. I also think that, look, I mean, politics has become a very big business. I mean, political consulting, lobbying certainly has become there's more money in politics now by maybe a factor of 100 than there was 20, 30 years ago, and that just keeps advancing. So it's easy to monetize your public service, and I think one of the core parts of the book is that self-service in Washington has replaced public service as really the overriding objective.
We're talking with Mark Leibovich, who just wrote this fantastic new book, This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, plus plenty of valet parking in America's gilded capital. Well, you just mentioned that this is problematic. And oh, by the way, if listeners want to call in and ask questions to Mark about what's going on in D.C., 877-301-8970 is the number, 877-301-8970. But is all this, you know, the celebrity culture, the millionaires that you talk about, you know, populating this place, putting them so out of touch with America, and just this sort of everybody scratching each other's back, this cannot be good for the republic here, can it?
I don't think it is. I don't think it is at all. I mean, I think what people intuitively know is that Washington is dysfunctional, Washington is disappointing. I mean, you can look at any number of national polls about how poorly Washington is performing, how poorly Congress is performing, the media, and go down the line. What I wanted to do is sort of get beyond the shorthand of Washington is dysfunctional. I wanted to tell people why they should hate Washington. I wanted to show people why. I mean, again, I'm sort of struck and actually kind of gratified by how people outside the Beltway have been, I think, rightly both entertained but disgusted by what I wrote. And because
that's exactly how I felt. Entertained.
Yes, I can totally live with that. Yeah. I mean, that's it's a tough balance to strike. And I mean, hopefully I did it okay. But you really, really cannot be, you know, a concerned American, a concerned citizen, and respect what is going on here.
One of the things that just struck me, and you go into it in great detail with examples of people, is this living with the fact that everybody has a conflict of interest. Ugh. Andrea Mitchell and Alan Greenspan, just to name one. Tammy Haddad, who was the booker to the stars I knew when I was at one of those cables for a while. Mm-hmm. Robert Barnett, the agent to the stars, who represents 347 people or something like that, you know, Robin from Peter to Pay Paul. Yeah, exactly. And these are names that we kind of know, you know, they're out there. But these people run the town.
They have made Washington work for them. I mean, again, and they are products of a marketplace and a machine. I mean, they are products of a lot of money. I mean, Tammy Haddad, who was basically kind of a glorified party.
She was the original booker for Larry King.
She was the booker for Larry King. Okay.
But she took off after that.
She did. I mean, she's kind of a star bleeper.
Yeah.
She loves being around famous people. She loves just sort of being in the room, putting parties together, just being someone.
She holds an annual White House correspondence dinner.
Brunch, which is just the mask of the Red Death, which it's really, I'm thankfully, thanks to this book, I'm blacklisted from
I'm
it,
sure.
So I don't
I was going to ask you that.
Oh,
no
more brunches for me.
No
that,
more
this
brunches.
Is fine. Well, not this brunch in particular, because I think Tammy was agreed.
She came off
her.
Fine.
That's what I would have thought, but I don't think, I've heard secondhand that she didn't like it. But anyway, but Tammy is now a businesswoman. Tammy is paid hundreds of thousands of dollars a year by media corp companies to help, in which she will throw parties for them, will get their sort of brand out there, will get them access to the White House. I mean, to me, that is the biggest, I mean, reveal here. I mean, the Obama administration was supposedly against the traditional influence peddlers of lobbyists or fixers like the old school sort of Clinton days. I mean, Tammy Haddad essentially helped like Newsweek land an interview with the president of the United States just by working her contacts and working all the people that she's raised money for. I mean, that's one of, I think, the kernels in there that people didn't fully know about. But to answer your question, Marjorie, what's been interesting about the response in town in D.C. has been the sort of how dare you tenor.
How
of
dare
it.
You?
How dare me?
Okay.
Meaning that
Mark
how
Leibovich.
Does an insider? How does an insider write critically about other insiders? This is against the unspoken rules. And look, I'm a journalist. I abide by ground rules. I abide by every rule that all of our professions would hold dear. But there is this club that I describe, and I was part of it. I think I still probably am by virtue of working for a news organization, but I don't care, frankly. I think that this is a story that needed to be written.
Well, you talk about, and then we should talk about the things that you say, the lobbying and so forth that has changed, and cable and all that has changed Washington, but you sort of have this, the two funeral thing. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about the Tim Russert funeral. Tell people now about the Richard Holbrooke funeral. And, of course, he was for years with the State Department.
Right.
Married to Peter Jennings' ex-wife.
Married to Cathy Martin.
Yes, that's right. And you worked for Peter Jennings. You're part of this little club, too,
Emily
Rooney.
I knew all these people.
Yeah, you knew all these people. You're guilty over there, Emily.
We're all guilty.
I lived in New York.
So what about tell people about the Richard Holbrooke funeral.
Well, Richard Holbrooke was actually great. I mean, he was the quintessential Washingtonian in that he worked it. He was always just fiercely, just like, he cared deeply. What is the president think of me? He was the special envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan for Hillary Clinton, who was basically his patron in the Obama administration. President Obama could not stand him. President Obama's team could not stand him. They thought he was just the kind of prima donna, full of himself kind of guy that they had no use for. And again, he died just a little later than the prime of his life. He was in his late 60s. I guess it was late in 2010. And that funeral, also at the Kennedy Center, it's interesting that these two funerals occurred at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. Okay.
nice symbol.
and the deities are everyone performing, right? But there were 15 eulogists, including Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and all these people who are no strangers to motorcades. And again, it was this great Washington pageant in which the Clinton Washington and the Obama Washington were sort of sniping at each other. And there was this great sort of political allegory taking place sort of in these sort of ostensibly mournful environments. But Richard Holbrooke, again, he despised Washington. He was very, very proud to be a New Yorker. He was very, very proud to go home at the end of the week, fly back to his apartment on the Upper West Side, take his dog tags off. Everyone wears these pictures of themselves around their necks in Washington. He said, Washington's the only city in the United States where people need pictures of themselves to remember who they are. And that was like his line. So anyway, yeah, he was a classic character also.
But they were faking it, and everybody was faking it at this funeral, and Barack Obama was disgusted by the whole thing. How could you tell he was disgusted by the whole thing?
Body language. His speech was completely pro forma. I mean, it was one of the most blah speeches of his presidency. I mean, he didn't like the guy. I mean, Barack Obama is not a terribly good poker player sometimes. He can be. But in this particular case, I mean, you could tell that, first of all, he hates listening to other people's speeches.
Yeah.
I mean, Vice President Biden used to speak endlessly before the president, and the president had to have Valerie Jarrett go tell Joe Biden's chief of staff to, like, can we stop this? Because I don't want to have to listen to these speeches. And so, you know, it's just like this final sort of curse to the president. The Holbrooke sort of made him listen to all 15 eulogies, many of them sort of taking thinly veiled shots.
Well, Clinton took a shot at Obama
at the
Holbrooke eulogy.
He said the Richard Holbrooke was good at doing. Well, people who didn't appreciate Richard Holbrooke were not as good as doing, and people sort of took that as a shot. So
Mark, your book is kind of being likened a little bit to the Mark Halperin, John Heilman book, Game Change, and that was criticized in Washington in some circles for being too gossipy. The big difference in my mind is that you're willing to take on your peers. I mean, Game Change was about the campaign operatives and behind the scenes and all that John Edwards stuff. This is different because you're naming names. How have people responded to you? Andrea Mitchell, some of the even if you're
Mika and Joe,
well they had me
on.
Joe. No, they had
me on.
Came
off well in your book.
Okay. I basically ignored them. I mean, not for.
But what about some of those? You know, like Andrea Mitchell.
I don't think she liked the book. I've heard that secondhand. I mean, Andrea Mitchell. I actually knew she wasn't going to like it because I had a very, difficult fact-checking conversation with her. And look, self-awareness is not a huge...
The thing about being called Barbara Walters?
Well, that was actually in her own memoir. Part of the reporting here is actually reading memoirs that very few other people did read. So, I learned that there. But the... everyone loves a winner, right? I mean, there was a lot of resentment about Game Change, and yet everyone showed up at the grand opening for the Game Change movie on HBO. I think people... I've actually gotten quite a few emails from people who are not flatteringly portrayed in the book that have been surprisingly humble and surprisingly, wow, it was really important to look at myself that way. I mean, these are like senators and former senators and members of Congress. That was surprising. But most people just... There have been a whole wave of people who wondered why they weren't in the book, a status kind of thing. A lot of people, I mean, Jay Carney, the White House press secretary, was asked in some briefing a couple weeks ago, have you read the Leibovich book? And he said, no, but I'm hoping to be invited to the book party. And
that's funny.
It was a funny line. And I sort of emailed him. I said, you know, you can come. It's like tomorrow night. And he goes, I can't believe I've been reduced to groveling from the podium. People have, I mean, I don't think, well, again, I don't think people have fully internalized, you know, maybe the larger outrage is there. And Washington loves an event, and I guess if they want to see this as an event, they can.
We're talking to Mark Leibovich, who's just written This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, about a very gilded, very over-the-top Capitol. Are there any heroes. You mentioned, and this sort of surprised me, Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, is a more real person. That's not the right adjective. Yeah. What are the adjectives?
Harry Reid, I would certainly shy away from calling him or really anyone heroes, but people say he comes off. I mean, the thing I like about Harry Reid is there's something extremely honest about him in that he has no filter. He will say anything. He does not have a care in the world about what anyone thinks of him. And it's one of the secrets to being in power. He will let all the show horses of his Democratic caucus get on TV, get the credit, do the sort of schmoozy thing that many senators are known for, as long as Harry Reid gets to be in charge. Harry Reid is I think, wouldn't say unappreciated, but people don't fully recognize the quirky, bizarre character that he is.
Because he's unimpressive when you see him on TV.
Oh, totally.
I mean, that's
one of the,
and you think this
him.
Guy used to be a big boxer. I mean, it's so hard to believe.
He's a bizarre character. I don't know. I mean, I like him because he's an original.
Is there anybody else like that doesn't care?
Tom Coburn is another senator, a very conservative Republican. I mean, he and Reid hate each other. They despise each other. He's someone who I think is a bit of an anti-hero. He's been called the father of the Tea Party. I mean, it's funny because the people on both the left and the right have tried to claim this book or this notion of this permanent feudal class as their own. I mean, Coburn actually coined the term. But, I mean, I think those are two people who are pointed to as unlikely, refreshing pieces of the book.
Now, you talk about this analogy to Morgan Freeman in Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, and this
talks about being
chapter. Yeah. The Roach Motel of Power is the chapter heading.
And how people become
institutionalized.
And how Barack Obama and his administration, when they first were marching towards the White House, said they will never bring lobbyists into the administration. It was a never, never, never scenario. And he has become as much of a Washington insider as witness bringing Bo on that helicopter over to the over to Martha's Vineyard.
Like, I know. Now, look, I mean, Washington, first of all, when you're a reelected president, I mean, I think as we're seeing, you kind of don't care anymore about the political niceties of where you put your dog on going on or where you go on vacation. But no, I mean, look, this administration was supposed to be different. I mean, the hope and change thing, I think, was probably sincere at the time. It was great marketing. But look, you keep saying never mind, like never mind that whole no lobbyists in the White House thing. No, never mind the we're not going to work with super PACs thing. I mean, if that happens, like if it keeps happening and happening, I mean, I'm allowed to be demoralized as a journalist, as a citizen. And look, I mean, they're all living in Washington. They ran against Washington and now they're all settling in, which is a very familiar story.
So should we be, again, concerned about this, that we need to do something, or is it just we just have to accept that everybody's in bed with everybody else and the lobbyists are there and it's all about millionaires and access? I mean, is it just hopeless?
It's funny. I hope not. I'm not a prescription guy. I mean, I'm not like a 10 bullet points at the end of the book in which I counsel everyone how the nation's capital can work better and we need term limits and we need campaign finance reform.
Do you think we do need term limits?
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, we need – look, we need – I actually – let me say this. I have a much greater sympathy for people on both sides who have out-and-out frustration and a belief that something completely new is necessary.
Well, you feel like – and I feel like this many times that you know, the great American century is behind us and we can't do anything anymore. And I really worry about, you know, my kids and my grandkids down the road that it's just, we're just on a big downhill slide because of this sort of – it's all about getting reelected. It's all about money and –
It's self-interest. And it's about Washington. I mean, Washington, again, I'm parochial maybe because I live there, but it's also a very important city, and it is as bad as we think. And it is, like as Coburn said, it's a permanent feudal class. It's a carnival. It's people who might come with the best intentions but who settle into it like a warm bath. And this is the wealthiest community in the United States right now. It's home to 7 of the wealthiest 10 counties in the United States right now. The Washington metropolitan area is – there's no motivation to change. There's no motivation to get things done.
You have a great story in here about this kid, not a kid anymore, but Kurt Bardella.
Tell us.
Who described as the most self-inflated press aide in the history of press aides. He worked for Daryl Issa. I had a nephew, by the way, who was the press aide to Anthony Weiner. Top that.
Really?
Yeah.
Oof.
But my point being this bad behavior gets rewarded in so many circles, but this this poor guy really took a hit.
Right.
Well, largely because of you.
largely because of me. Yeah, I was in the middle of this chapter. This was chapter, I think it's 8 or something like that.
Your chapter names are great, yeah. By the way.
I think this one was called How It Works. Kurt Bardella is the press secretary to Darrell Issa, who's the head of the Government Reform and Oversight Committee, a very powerful Republican on the Hill. Kurt is, you know, like many kind of sort of young, insecure people, very driven, came to Washington, wanted to reinvent himself. He loved West Wing. He's part of this generation of kids who don't grow up idolizing John F. Kennedy or Ronald Reagan. They grew up idolizing President Bartlett or Josh Lyman or something.
Yes.
Kurt was one of these. He said, I'm not so much a Democrat or Republican as I am an opportunist. And again, I kind of loved him for his transparency there. It was a little bit much after a while, but he started sending me these. He was one of my subjects for this chapter. He started sending me emails from reporters, from members of Congress, as a way of showing me a window into how he spent his days. And eventually Politico learned about this. It became a massive scandal on Capitol Hill in a week in which the Republicans were threatening to shut down the government. And this was the only story in town. Of course, no one here remembers it or even knows about it because, we really didn't matter. But hundreds of stories were written about it, and I just sort of took that as a narrative of really, he got fired. He got fired.
Yeah.
He came back into his old job, I think at a higher salary.
Later.
6 months later. He got asked to go on CNN as a talking head to talk about birtherism. He was invited to parties. People saw him on the street. They forgot what he was infamous for. But they said, hey, your brand
somebody.
Is, you're somebody. And that's the
Amazing
way it works.
Story.
You get this neutral sheen of notoriety rather than any kind of sense that you've done wrong.
Well, you talk about the four things that have changed. So the lobbyists, that's a big, huge thing. The 24-hour news hole with cable is the celebrity. Everybody's a celebrity thing. What's the fourth thing?
Let's see. What is the fourth thing?
It's like, what's his name?
Like
Rick Perry.
Perry. Yeah, although I think I'm trying to
your
think
Rick
of,
Perry moment.
Okay, so lobbying, just celebrity. Oh, new media.
New media. Okay, Twitter, Facebook, everybody
all
wanted
that
to be
is
on
exaggerated. Again, it has made the sort of self-branding craze. Anyone can be famous. Mm. Anyone can develop a second act. You can monetize. That's a terrible new Washington word, but everyone knows. You can monetize your identity to a degree which you never could before. So again, it rewards self-interest instead of public service.
You know, you had a great quote here, and this I found depressing, too, from Rahm Emanuel. He was a big aide in the White House. And
chief
then he
of
was,
staff.
Yeah, chief
mayor
of staff.
Mayor of Chicago.
And now, exactly, now he's the mayor of Chicago. Listen to this. A man never stands taller than when he is down on all fours kissing somebody's, I'm going to paraphrase you, derriere.
Sucking up. That's suck up city.
He would never,
suck up
ever
city.
Use the word derriere.
No, he did not use
right
the word
now.
Derriere. He used a different word, but we're not going to use
the other
it
thing.
There.
Language. That's a whole other thing.
Yeah,
language terrible. Down there.
Yes.
And that sort of encapsulated the suck up city chapter.
Oh, totally. Now, look, sycophancy is sycophanticness. What's the word?
Whatever it is.
It greases everything. And, look, it's one of the things I hate about it. Again, it's you get used to being spoken to in a language that most people don't realize is abnormal. People in Washington don't realize is abnormal. It's obsequiousness. It's browbeating sometimes. It's just very, very unctious kind of back and forth. And, it wears you down.
So. Yeah, I was last week when that's the second round of the Anthony Weiner thing broke, when that aide wrote the note back
print.
That's the way they talk to each other. That's not unusual to use the F word every third word in these. This is Congress. This is staff.
Oh no, Anthony Weiner is notorious for that. He was not a very pleasant guy to work for back when he was in Congress. But again, look, I don't think he's going to win now. But he, Elliot Spitzer, Mark Sanford. It's all a great example of how the unemployment line in politics is not very long. If and when Anthony Weiner loses, I'd hardly be shocked if he got a great radio gig or cable gig or book deal or something like that. No, he'll be fine. I don't know if his wife and he are going to stay together.
So, Mark Leibovich, author of This Town, one last thing because we got to go in just a few seconds. Are you going to stay in Washington for the rest of your career? Do you think you might relocate to New York?
I don't know. If I'm driven out of town, maybe that's part of the master plan. It sounds like a contradiction. We have a nice life there. Our kids like their schools.
Okay.
My wife likes her job. So there I am for now.
We were speaking with New York Times chief national correspondent Mark Leibovich about his latest book, This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, plus plenty of valet pay parking in America's gilded capital. When we come back, we'll look at a book that recalls the days when things seemed downright harmonious in D.C. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're digging into our archives and playing a collection of author interviews. We're continuing the conversation with Chris Matthews. He dropped by earlier this year when he was promoting his latest book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. What a difference a couple of decades make. In the early 80s, Ronald Reagan was president. GOP held a majority in the Senate. House was led by Massachusetts Democrat Tip O'Neill. Despite deep ideological differences, the two leaders made things work. This unusual relationship between O'Neill and Reagan is the subject of a new fabulous book by MSNBC host Chris Matthews. The title, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Works, seems particularly relevant now. Chris Matthews, great to see you.
Thanks, Jim.
Oh, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Marjorie.
You have a lot of great quotes from Ronald Reagan's diary in your book.
How about the cactus one?
Yeah. I mean, good for him for keeping these diaries, but this is one I wanted to read. Tip is a true pal. He can really like you personally and be a friend while politically trying to beat your head in. How different that strikes me as a relationship between the speaker now, John Boehner, and Barack Obama.
Yeah, I think, you know, this after six thing, we didn't know about it at the time from the speaker. He never mentioned it. But when I first met Ronald Reagan, I met him three or four times when he came up to give the State of the Union. And his holding room was the speaker's ceremonial office, H209, which was right off the House chamber. So when he was in there getting, the dogs would come in and sniff for drugs and everything, on the, or bombs, I should say, maybe drugs too, on the floor of the House, the speaker would be gone. He'd be down in his private office, and I'd be out there at my desk right outside that office. So I went in to see the president. I don't know what moved me to do it, but I went and said, Mr. President, welcome to the room where we plot against you. And he said, oh, no, not after six. He said, the speaker says we're all friends after six.
Yeah.
And I heard that. I didn't know what to make of that. And then years later, when the speaker retired and wrote in his memoirs, that was in there.
What's the cactus? I've read about 100 pages of the book. Marjorie got through the whole thing.
Are you ready for gross? Are you ready for gross?
Well, I'll tell you after you tell the story. Go ahead.
Aren't you sweet?
Go ahead.
Jim, this is about negotiations, which is really a heart of the book, which is how the two guys here at 180 agree in the interest of the country. Let's be honest about it. I don't give it schmaltzy. It's in the interest of the country. And they were in this room, and it was April of 82. And Reagan had started to lose some of his firepower because we're in a recession. And Tip had him. It was getting a little interesting there. And they went in. They knew the Reagan people wanted to cut Social Security. They want to play around with it. And Tip was ready to deal on the issue of maybe we'll give back some of the tax cuts and we'll have to give back on some of the Social Security COLAs. And I was getting real nervous about it. But anyway, that didn't work because we found out that they were trying to blame the Democrats for cutting Social Security, which is an absurdity. So what happened was Jim Wright, who wasn't so adroit in politics as Tip, and he, by the way, I never called him Tip. I called him Mr. Speaker then, but it's faster now, easier too. He offered some bunch of spending cuts, and then he said, and then we'll get rid of the third year of the tax cut. And Reagan said, only Reagan can talk like this in the background. Okay, guys, I can crap a pineapple. I can't crap a cactus. That's your president.
I think that
this is how these guys talk in the back room. And Reagan would always tell these Irish jokes that were pretty gross too. And Tip would match it with his. This thing about matching each other. I don't know about you guys, but I can't remember more than one or two jokes at a time.
I can't remember any.
And these guys had the ability. One of my brothers, Bruce, can do this, which is memorize every joke he ever knew and always have it ready to top the other guy. So they had these jokes. Reagan, when his career was really down in like before he got GE Theater, he was out there working in Vegas, leading on sort of an act. He was a review act, and he was telling Irish jokes. That's all he did was tell Irish jokes with that Hollywood brogue, you know. So this is how they talked. It could get Reagan. I think having gotten to know some of the Reagan people over the years, they like gross jokes. That was just one little thing they liked to do. I think Nancy likes them too.
That's the key to good government. Obviously,
gross
now, Chris Matthews.
It shakes. It loosens up the other side.
You know, when I started reading this thing, I was hoping that there'd be tons of lessons that are transferable here, and I think there are. But then at the same time, I said to myself, the reason that worked is because of the two men and their approach. So how transferable is the Reagan O'Neill world to 2013
America?
Well,
it's not a how-to book. It's a book of stories about how they did do it to sort of maybe inspire people to get back to that mindset. I mean, it's a different mindset. You're right. It isn't just like, you know, here's your operator's guide to being a leader. Mm-hmm. You have to know how to be a leader. But there are some interesting things that do fit fairly neatly if they decide they want to get along at some point, like after a couple more weeks of this brouhaha, and they end up with the debt ceiling, which is real, and they all sort of agree, except for the crazies on the right, they got to do something. They can't go over the, they can't go deadbeat here. They were trying to get the debt ceiling through early in 1981 when Reagan first came to office, and he needed Democrats because Tip ruled at least a nominal majority in the House. So Max Friedersdorfer, who was Reagan's chief of congressional relations, came to the speaker and said, can we get some votes? And the speaker said, Yeah, you get some votes. All I want is a letter from the president asking for them so that they would be covered in the next election. Now, who thinks like that? Just a letter to each one of these guys, and all of a sudden, they're doing business together because they just, it was like putting up the white flag. Neither side's going to gain on this issue. We have to get the debt ceiling through, so let's agree that we're not going to screw each other on it. So I want the letter. And he'd do a lot of that. He'd do things like that with Social Security, or he'd say, you know, who wants to raise taxes in 82? But if you give me 100 Republican votes, I'll give you 118 Democratic votes, and that way big business won't just be mad at us again.
Well, what it seems to me, I know you'll correct me if I'm wrong, what made the 50, I need 50 votes and I'll get them for you if there's a letter,
kind of
particularly
stuff.
Amazing. Didn't that come just a year or so after there was, I think you said this, it was not one GOP vote that Carter was able to get for a similar debt ceiling thing?
It's in the book,
So it's, right. So it's,
it was like breaking loose what had been just a turf war, you know, almost, you know, what's that word? What do they call it? Burnt earth or whatever.
So just scorched earth.
Yeah.
Where you just fight for everything.
Yeah.
And the other side just kills people just to get a victory, a marginal victory, which helps nobody. In this case, they said, look, we can do this together. In that case, they said, we didn't want any Republicans. We'll just match your votes. But in other words, like the tax reform bill, which was tough on corporations, Tip said, I won 50 votes. And he made them sweat. You know, he's sitting over at the Phoenix Hotel having dinner with his crowd over there. Did I say that right? Dinner?
Dinner.
He's
having
he's having dinner with his crowd, waiting, knowing that Reagan was sweating it out. Then he called in and told Jim Baker, you got the votes, but then you got the passage.
You know, I didn't think of this. We're talking with Chris Matthews from MSNBC about Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Work, his brand new book. Didn't occur to me, I should have, until I read this book, the whole Irish Catholic thing.
Yeah.
I mean, that they came from different backgrounds.
Well, Ronald Reagan was Protestant because his mom was Protestant. His dad was definitely Irish Catholic, and his brother Neil was raised Irish Catholic. I think
how does that matter,
the Irish thing is real. I mean, there's a great Latin word for when you're with the Irish. I feel it, too. When you get together, there's a great sense of together, you know, and it's very emotional. And I'm not sure Reagan didn't lose a lot of that when he went to Hollywood, but it really worked in Hollywood professionally for him because when he got to Hollywood and he's doing okay, Pat O'Brien was huge in those days, the actor who starred in the Rocky Story. And he had a part of the room in the Warner Brothers commissary where you sat with him. He was the king. And there were guys like Spencer Tracy and all, but O'Brien decided who sat with them. Okay, and it was a bit tribal, to say the least. They let in a few non-Irish, like Bogart, but when Reagan came along, Pat decided to let him sit with those guys. It's like in high school, it's like a Holy Cross sitting with the jocks. You know, it's the whole thing.
Who does
he
get? Well,
he went to Holy Cross.
He gets to sit with the jocks, and the Irish were the jocks. And then when it came time to cast the George Gipp, the Gipper, in that movie, which is enormous to us growing up, the Notre Dame Story, Newt Rockne All-American. He decided to push him for the party. He went out there and pushed him for it. Reagan went back at his yearbook from Eureka, showed he could play football. Pat O'Brien went to Jack Warner and said, most people don't know a football from a cantaloupe. This guy's a football player. Give him the job. And he even did the screen test with him. So I really think he owed a lot to Pat O'Brien and the Irish crowd.
Okay. Yeah. Great picture of him catching the football, too. You have a million great stories about Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan. Tell people about when Ronald Reagan was nearly killed at the Hinckley assassination. What about Tip O'Neill going to the hospital?
Well, because Jim Baker, who I've come, he was real waspy, excuse me, SOB in many ways. But he was something to deal with. But he knew how to do it. And he knew how important it was that the leader of the opposition, the second in line to the presidency, be the first one in to see the president. Now, Reagan almost died. They kept that really secret. The bullet came right near his heart. He lost half his blood supply internally. It was just horrendous. They didn't want that out. They didn't want the world to know that. So when they decide finally to let the speaker in. And he goes in, and I had an eyewitness there who said that he walked across the room, waved to the guy he knew in the room, walked over to the bed, knelt down next to the bed, and held Reagan's hands, both of them, and they prayed the 23rd Psalm together.
Oh, my God.
The Lord is my shepherd. And I talked to Susan, Tip's daughter, who said he definitely knew that one. And so, and then he kissed him on the forehead, and Reagan said something like, "Thanks for coming, Tip." And it was very emotional, I bet, and very wonderful, I think.
We're talking to Chris Matthews.
And nobody knew about that. I got that from the guy.
That's a great story.
Nobody knew
it's
that.
It's a great story.
You know, I watch you on MSNBC. I say to myself, best job in America. But then I read your book, and I say, that was the best job in America. Did you appreciate it then, or did you need as the space of a couple of decades to realize how lucky you were to be right in the middle of this whole
thing? Well, I did keep a journal. And Reagan's diary, as you mentioned, is fabulous. And we did get, although Tip didn't keep a journal, we did get a friend of mine, Eric Schwartz, a young guy who worked downtown. He secretly kept a recording of every morning press conference with Tip. And I didn't know about this. I sort of heard about it, but we didn't want to put it out because we didn't want to be giving reporters verbates on what Tip had said. If you're there, okay. If you're not there, tough luck. That was our view because we wanted people to come. So I was able to put together with my journals and everything. So I must have thought it was important enough. But one reason I kept my journal was to keep myself sane. You know, a lot of times you have to write every day just say, okay, here's what we went through last. This is brutal. We're trying this and some fights with him and me. You know, he'd blame me for something, which is normal in politics. But did I know it? I think I knew it. But of all the three or four things I've done in my life, the Good Friday Agreement up there in Northern Ireland, the first all-race election in South Africa, voting with Bishop Tutu, being with him, interviewing Mandela, the whole thing. And the Berlin Wall, which stands out as my favorite, into being in West Berlin and East Berlin, hanging around interviewing people and what it meant to them, standing with them in the middle of the night saying, "What does freedom mean to you?" As the gates were, Brandenburg Gate was going to open, and people saying, I said, "What was ist Freiheit? What does it mean to you?" And the guy said, "Talking to you." I will never forget that one.
Hey, so Chris Matthews.
Isn't that a killer?
That is a killer.
We've talked a lot on the show about, with Chris Lydon, actually. Chris and I and Marjorie is yet to see All the Way with Bryan Cranston doing LBJ.
Somebody called me this morning and said you have to see it.
It is beyond spectacular. Both Cranston himself and the play is just it's a wonderful view of Johnson. If Tip O'Neill had to deal with an extreme left wing of the Democratic caucus, like John Boehner's got to deal with an extreme right wing of his caucus, how would O'Neill have handled that?
Well, there's no comparison because Tip was on the liberal left side of the party. He was very patriotic, of course, but he wasn't what you call a movement lefty or anything like that. Well, there was one example, however, which was interesting, and I put it in the book. When he was when Reagan was going to meet with Gorbachev at Reykjavik, the deal-making deal, when they really sat down and talked about eliminating all nuclear weapons. Even though they didn't do it, that was the great moment when Gorbachev told the prime minister of Iceland, "We have just witnessed the beginning of the end of the Cold War." We're talking about a big moment. Well, anyway, to get ready, Tip was always, and I never knew this, in the back room making sure that the Democrats didn't do anything to upset those talks. He didn't want any distractions or any. In the first talks in Geneva, he said, you know, he went over and represented Reagan in that first meeting. He gave him the letter from Reagan saying he wanted to meet with Gorbachev. You wouldn't see that today. You know,
no.
Boehner going over for Obama to meet with Putin. You wouldn't have that kind of a situation. But that was more the norm back in the old days, like back in World War II when it was about to begin because of Pearl Harbor. Roosevelt sent Wendell Willkie over as his envoy to Western Europe. So, I mean, this was a natural American unity thing that we have really lost. But in this case, Reykjavik, Ed Markey, the senator now, and Ron Delms, who were on the Democratic peace, what do you call it, the freeze movement, Freeze was big back then, and they wanted to freeze all production of nuclear weapons on our side, as if because they thought that, well, that would sort of send a message or set good example for the other side, which you could argue wasn't going to do anything of the kind.
As Chris Matthews rolls his eyes, by the way, for those of you
well,
not watching
on TV. Well, because it's very hopeful.
TV.
It's very hopeful. And I mean, I'm supportive. Of course, we all were hoping that we didn't know how we'd get out of the Cold War. Maybe the freeze would work. But he brought in Dellums into the room, who represents Berkeley, and they always say Berkeley has its own foreign policy, and those two guys are very good friends. And if, according to the accounts I've been able to get, they sat in the room with Tip, and he said, look, I promised to back you guys on a freeze vote, and I'm with you if you want to have one. But it's not a good time to have a freeze vote to embarrass the president when he's going over to meet with Reykjavik on this very important, perhaps war-ending meeting. And they're all crying in the room because they all decided that this was a moment. They could have won the big vote, but they knew it was in the interest of the country, and they all decided. Tip said, it's up to you guys, but they decided not to do it. His ability to bring people into a room, the speaker, and get them to sort of agree, even though I don't know how he did it, but he had a number of tricks. One was, if there's two guys fighting over turf, over who has the committee with legitimate jurisdiction, and sometimes I wondered how people were so dumb as to fall for it, he would yell at the guy he agreed with. And don't you do this again. And the minute I heard him say it, he just agreed with the guy. What do you mean, don't you do it again? And then they'd come out of the room with the guy who lost the fight but didn't know it. And say, God, he really tore him a new one. You know, I'd say, didn't you see what he just did? But he also would, you can't do this today. It's not politically correct. He would close the door to his room. It was always in his room. He'd sit behind this big desk, like a judge's desk, smoking that stogie, the big one, well lit. The room would get hotter and hotter. I think he actually had Leo turn the heat up, you know, Leo deal. And it got so hot and smoky in that room. And he'd never get out of that desk. He made people sit around him like an auditorium around him. He's the boss. And he would listen to both sides. And I love watching them. And all you could think about is how great it's going to be out of this room. And go, because the Capitol was always incredibly air-conditioned in the summer. You know, it was like an igloo. I mean, you walk out in the room, and, great, it's cold. I love this. And you could breathe. And I think he knew he could limit the length of a meeting that way.
So, Chris Matthews, you just said that
I know
talking,
he
about,
did.
Talking about American unity, that we've lost it.
Yeah.
So why do you think that is? Is it the people, or is it the time, or is it the media? Why have we lost it?
Well,
that?
The media doesn't help, but anger. You know, it's just this deep gut anger, the hatred. In some quarter, I'm not saying Republicans all hate Obama, but some of them do. About 20%.
So is that Fox News and Rush Limbaugh?
I know these guys. I think they're exploiting it. I think it's there. It's part ethnic. Let's be honest. It's the birther thing is all ethnic. It's part hatred of Washington, which is pretty American. But I guess it's the economic squeeze. I don't doubt this thing people talk about, this cultural change, demographic change. If you live in a small southwestern town and it gets more and more Hispanic, well, most people would be upset. It's just too much change. And maybe a few people, but when all of a sudden your whole world is different, the languages you hear are different, the people look different, it's harder to take. I think that's part of it. I think the economic squeeze on the middle class is part of it. But just people are in a bad mood. I mean, look at this guy, Cruz. He's not a happy-looking guy.
He's not happy.
But, you know, he, without being too specific, just think about when I grew up. Who did everybody like in my family? My mom, for example. When I went home, we first got our TV set. You know what was on? McCarthy hearings. She wasn't rooting for the witnesses. She was rooting for McCarthy, okay? I knew who Mary Shields was rooting for. So the anger against the establishment is not new. I mean, real anger against the establishment. That explains McCarthy. He had a 4.5-year run where everybody's scared to death of him. And to that extent, it's like Cruz. People are really afraid of him. Today, and it just came out on the wires today, an hour or so ago, Boehner has now pulled back the word that leaked out that he might be dealing with a coalition, not with a straight Republican thing. He might be willing to end this fight.
Violating the so-called Denny Hastert rule.
Even violating, that's right. Mm-hmm. And I think that, or even violating to the point of including any Democrats in his coalition to end this thing. So he's scared to death of the right still. And I think that's a lot like McCarthy must have been.
How does it end? How does it end? And
a week
it
begins to end. Just because of the pain of these closings and all. How about every time you go through an airport now, which I do all the time now, and you know, Tina and I were talking to the TSA guy, he's not getting paid. And he's the guy watching that scanner. You know, he's watching.
Wait, I thought they're essentials. Are they not essentials?
Well, they have to work, but they're not getting paid. That's the combination.
I didn't know that.
They have
either.
To work and they don't get paid.
Isn't that a
violation
of some
label? And I know a guy who's got
label?
A really high level job in TSA in the back room when they study all this data, he's not getting paid. So this is going to, you could do this for a week. Without a lot of pain. Some families don't live every week to week. They can make it. Then the second week, they can't quite make it. or they barely make it. By the third week, people are out of money. And so they got to pay bills. So this is going to get really hot. And I think also the uncertainty about whether I'll ever get back pay. They're not necessarily going
to
get it.
That vote today is going to pass in the House to agree up front to give them retroactive pay,
imagine,
but it's not going to pass the Senate, right?
We'll see. I don't know.
Hey,
but I do think that's the thing that's wearing at us. But the big thing, of course, is October 17th, and when we go dead
that's
people.
Yeah, very scary.
And I hear that the 24th, the checks don't go out. Like, you know, I said that people used to have, like, an airliner. If an airliner said 95% safety record, you wouldn't get on it. You look around for the 100% safety record. 100 years now, people have putting their money in the United States because we're the 100% safety record. We've always paid the paper boy who had a savings bond. He always knew he didn't make the most off the government when he bought a savings bond, but he always got the money. The Chinese billionaire who hates us, he always gets the money. Now we'll be a country that doesn't necessarily give you the money. There was that screw up in 13, remember? And that becomes part of our record. And that means all the interest rates have to be higher to get the money, right?
Yeah, it's
very
scary.
And we become like some state that had Illinois or somebody that doesn't pay his bonds or somebody.
Detroit.
This is really scary. And I think almost 80% of the Republicans agree with the Democrats this is something that has to be dealt with. But you get some of these characters, sagebrush right-wing Republicans. I had a guy on, this guy King from the Midwest. I said to him, and this is the last time we did this, 2 years ago, in 11, I said, well, aren't you worried about a default? He said, no. I said, why not? He said, don't you listen to international economists? He said, I don't listen to international economists. Like, they're foreigners. And then I said, what about domestic economists? Well, they're intellectuals. He said, I don't listen to them either. They're intellectuals. So I said, how do you make these judgments? He said, I raised a family. This kind of horse sense.
And we all,
does anybody fix their own teeth?
No.
Does anybody fix their own plumbing? You usually go to a guy that knows what he's doing, or a woman. With this idiotic notion of I can do it all, I can think through these complicated issues, you got to be stupid to think that.
Hey, before you go away, your last book, what's it called? JFK, Elusive Hero. Chris Lydon was here yesterday, and we were talking about James Douglas's book, which is Unspeakable, which is obviously back in the news. Even Jesse Ventura has written a book about the assassination. We're almost on the 50th anniversary of JFK. Where are you
Commission? I'm totally, well, I don't want to call it that because that sounds derogatory.
Well, the Lee Harvey Oswald.
I think Lee Harvey Oswald did it. I think his pattern of going after Edwin Walker before that, General Edwin Walker, thinking he was going after Nixon. He got confused about that. I wrote about it in my book on Kennedy and Nixon. I think the Bugliosi, I believe completely what he has to say. I look at it this way because a lot of evidence about, you know, they were all looking up at that window. They thought that was it. But my big question to the I challenged Jesse in the hallway the other day because I think they're all crazy, but I think it's brain soup more than evidence. Lee Harvey Oswald has that job at the Book Depository way before there was any motorcade route set up. So if you believe there was a conspiracy, you have to believe that the Kennedy people themselves, the Irish Mafia, Kenny O'Donnell and those guys, systematically brought Kennedy to where he would be shot. And if you can come up with any other logical explanation or the pure coincidence, and if it was a coincidence, why would it be a big conspiracy about shooting him there involving Oswald? Because they always admitted it involved him in the conspiracy. So how could they have logically... Only a crazy person thinks like that. Like the people who say that Obama's mother married a guy named Hussein Obama in Kenya and went over there to have the baby so that she could deny it later. What are we, all nuts? And I just think, and I confronted him with that, and then he starts giving me all this FBI, CIA, and the Irish, because they all had to do it. And the people that are willing to believe in these conspiracy theories are willing to go full moon on this. They will tell you everybody was out to kill him. Now, I'll tell you a story about the Kennedy guys around him. They loved him. And everybody knows they loved him. And one of the great stories is our parish is Blessed Sacrament right on the D.C. line. And not far from me, about a mile walk from me, is Gar's Funeral Home. And everybody goes there eventually. That's where you go, okay? And that's where the Irish Mafia, Kenny O'Donnell, Larry O'Brien, those guys, and Dave Powers all drove up that night, the 22nd of November, 1963. They drove up by themselves to pick out a coffin for their friend. These guys love the guy. And the idea that they would participate in this is an absurdity, and it's cruel. And that's why I think guys like Jesse have just got their own psychological problems.
That was MSNBC's Chris Matthews talking about his latest book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked. When we come back, Harvard Business School's Michael Norton on his book about the relationship between happiness and money. That's next on Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're rebroadcasting some of the author interviews we've had over the past year. We're continuing the conversation with behavioral economist Michael Norton, whose latest book, Happy Money, suggests that money doesn't exactly buy happiness. It's how we spend it that does. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. This question is quite simple. How much money do you need to be happy? If you say the more the better, no matter how much, you'd be wrong. Our guest is here to tell you why. He's an associate professor at Harvard Business School, co-author of the brand new book, Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Michael Norton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, now I have read $75,000 you can be happy on. But I was happy to know that it's $163,000 in New York City. So what is it in Boston? Because I don't think I could be thrilled on $75,000 in Boston.
So why is that? Why do you think that you need more than that?
I have a mortgage. A mortgage, college educations, taxes. It's a very expensive place to live here. You know what I'm saying?
She wants a cost of living adjustment,
I think,
Michael.
But I would be moving serious. To a triple decker in Chelsea. I'd be in the basement apartment for $75,000.
I think you're being facetious. You have actually quantified with your research
and
some of your writings what is the level above which the additional happiness is meager at best. And the average number is that $75,000 that Marjorie talked about, no?
That is right. So across all people, it turns out that around $75,000 of income, you don't get much more benefit from making more. So it's never bad, actually, to make more money, which sometimes people think that you're going to be unhappy. It turns out not so much. It just doesn't do much for you after that amount.
How do you quantify the happiness thing? I understand how you can do a dollar thing. How do you quantify the increasing level of happiness that it's associated with every additional dollar?
So the funny thing about happiness is if I asked you right now on a scale from 1 to 71, how happy are you? You could come up with a number pretty quickly.
Yeah, we could.
Oddly enough, you might say 63, you might say 54, whatever you're going to say. And that sticks with you. So if I ask you that again next year, you're probably this kind of the same number you were now. If something good happened to you, you're probably higher. If something bad happened, you're probably lower. We can look at that number that you give us and look across many, many people and look how much money all of those people make and just see what's the point at which more money doesn't seem to shift around that 54 or that 64, whatever you might be. And it turns out, oddly enough, it's a lot lower than what people think. It seems to be around, again, on average, $75,000.
That's the voice of Michael Norton from Harvard Business School, who's quantified happiness as it relates to dollars and cents.
But you scaled around my original question here, Michael, though. $75,000 generally in the United States, $163,000 in New York City. So what are we talking in Boston? $120,000?
Probably somewhere 110? In the middle. Probably somewhere in the middle. But
the
key thing really for us is not so much how much money you have is predicts how happy you are, but it's really what you do with it. So we tend to think that it's the amount of money that we have that makes us happy. And all of our research and research by lots of other people really says that it's what you do with the money that's at least as important as how much of it you actually have.
And what are the things that you should do with your money that will make you happier?
So the first thing is, what do people usually do with it? And it turns out what we usually do with it, and I'm guilty of this too, is we buy junk for ourselves.
Yep.
So we buy TVs and we buy stuff and we keep buying more and more of it. And the very first thing that my co-author Liz Dunn and I tried to do was shift that paradigm and tell people, quit spending it all on yourself all the time. And why don't you try giving a little bit more to other people and see if giving it away to other people actually might make you happier.
Mm-hmm.
And your conclusion was?
It does, oddly enough. So people will say, geez, I'd really rather have the $5 or $20 for myself. But when we do experiments, we literally give people money on the street and we tell them, go out and do things with it. So we tell people, spend it on yourself, spend it on somebody else. When we call them up later, the people who spend it on themselves, they're not less happy, just like making more money doesn't make you less happy, but they're not happier. It didn't do anything for them to buy themselves a coffee. But people who went and spent it on somebody else, when we call them back, they actually got happier as a result.
Okay, now I hurt my foot and I was laid up for a couple of days and I was online shopping, something I don't do that often. And I did buy myself a bunch of things. And
happiest she's been in months, Michael, I want you to know.
I did feel kind of happy about that. But that's, if you did that all the time, it would be a problem. I mean, you have a very fascinating theory about sort of like the first sip of the soda. And maybe that was, I'm not usually online shopping. And maybe because it was an unusual experience for me, it made me happy. Tell people about that.
That's absolutely right. So another huge mistake that we make. So not only do we buy ourselves stuff all the time, but we buy ourselves the same stuff over and over and over again. And we get tired of it. It still is pretty good, but we should take a break from it in some sense, and we'll like it even more. And we always talk about it. It's like eating a huge chocolate cake. So you start eating the cake, and
he's looking at me when he said, "This I'm not looking anywhere." He's staring at me. Go ahead,
I was
Michael.
Looking out the window. I was totally neutral. So we always, you know, the first bite of a huge chocolate cake is amazing. So is the tenth. Chocolate cake is amazing.
It is.
But you keep eating it, and you never stop. And by the hundredth bite, you're going to keep going, but it just doesn't taste good anymore. If you would just take a little break from it and come back the next day, that bite would be as good as the first bite was again. And we see people doing this all the time. One of the worst things people do now is binge DVD watching. You watch the entire season of a show in one day. People
stay
up all night.
One of my favorite activities in the world.
Absolutely. Me too, except it would be better, oddly enough, if you took a break. Imagine you made yourself wait a whole week to watch the next episode. You'd be dying with anticipation. And that's a good feeling. That's a whole other source of happiness.
Actually, you know, it is great. We talk about The Sopranos a lot here because it's my favorite show of all time. The anticipation for Sunday night all week long, waiting for it to come, was huge. You know, we're talking to Michael Norton, and you may think he's from some ashram somewhere. Listening to him, he's from Harvard Business School. He has a brand new book out just today called Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending.
You also talked about, and I think this does ring true, is that spending money on experiences works well happiness-wise. What's up with that?
Experiences are one of the most underutilized things that we can buy. So experiences can be anything from, you know, a two-week amazing European vacation or just a meal out, a cheap meal out, but with somebody that you love.
Yeah.
And experiences, again, if you think about why experiences are great, when you buy things for yourself, again, you tend to use them by yourself. So if you get a TV, you're thinking, oh, I'm going to have this TV in the house. My family will watch it together. I'll have friends over and we'll watch it. And it turns out that what people mainly do with their TV is they sit in a room by themselves and stare at it for hours and hours and hours. Me too. We all do this kind of thing.
You use the term, everybody knows the term overindulgence. In a piece that you and your co-author wrote for the New York Times last year, Don't Indulge, Be Happy, you talked about a term which I guess you invented, underindulgence. What does that mean? Why should we even be thinking about that? What's up, Michael Norton?
This is the one of the hardest things for humans to do, actually, is if we love something and we have it in front of us, it is incredibly difficult not to consume it right then. It could be cake, it could be The Sopranos, it could be whatever it is. But it turns out that if we underindulge in things, we don't tell people to stop. So a lot of people say, don't buy anything and live. That's sort of the ashram kind of advice. That's even harder for people to do. We basically say, you don't have to stop to get more happiness out of how you spend your money. You just need to shift even little things in what you do. And one way to do it is underindulge. So don't watch every episode of The Sopranos right in a row. Take a break, underindulge for a week.
It's like portion control in life. Is that essentially what you're describing?
That's exactly right.
I think that's so true. I mean, your thing about the chocolate cake, that's not fun to be on your third piece of chocolate cake. It just makes you sick to your stomach on top of it. But to get back, I hate to obsess about the money thing.
Sure.
But one of the things, you know, when you're broke, and we've all been broke, is that your anxiety level about paying the rent and having enough money and, you know, it's payday. You can't pay the toll on the Mass Pike because you're broke until you get your next paycheck. I don't see how, especially in an expensive place to live, the anxiety of not having enough, or even worrying about not having enough when you retire, which no one can do anymore unless they work for the government, because you're not going to be on enough then. How does that work out?
It's a great question, because the psychology is very, very complicated. So you're absolutely right that if you have a very low standard of living and you make more money, it does in fact make you happier. And it's exactly for the reasons you're describing. The stress of not being able to pay the rent. Can I afford food for my children this month? But once you start to make, let's say, $75,000, one of the things you do is you don't keep your life the way it was and now you can pay all your expenses. The mistake that we make is we say, I'm making more money. I should buy more stuff. I'm going to get a bigger house.
Okay.
I'm going to get a bigger car. I'm going to get a new TV. And then we're right back where we were before, worrying about money all the time and being in debt again. And there's a really sad fact of the psychology of money, which is that the amount of money that you have saved doesn't predict your happiness very well. But the amount of debt you have really negatively predicts your happiness. So we don't get a huge bonus from being good, but we get a huge hit from being bad.
You know, much of what you say, I have to say, at initial blush for me was totally counterintuitive. But then I'm trying to think, prior to being exposed to you, I'm trying to think, where have I heard or seen something like this? The only thing I can come up with was, you know, those surveys that come out every couple of years, I'm sure you've looked at them closely, where they ask the average hard-driving type A personality, if you had a choice between making $50,000 more, I'm making up the number, or spending more time with your kids when they're young, which would you do? Stunning percentages of people, including the most hard-driven types, say, I'd give up the increase to spend more time with the kids. That's a variation on your theme, obviously, is it not?
That's exactly right. But what those people do in their life is, if you ask people at any moment, should you go to work today or should you spend time with your kids? Most people will say, spend time with my kids. Then you see what they do. They go to work.
Go to work. And so how do you explain that?
It's really, really hard for us to get it right. So we know things are good for us. It's a little bit like exercise. We know that if we exercise today, we're going to feel better next week. I just don't feel like it. In the moment today, I know that I shouldn't stay at work for an extra 6 hours. But I can't help it because I'm in the moment.
Okay, so let's assume you weren't an associate professor at Harvard Business School, but you were a shrink. And someone said to you, I'm making that $75,000. And I've been offered...
By the way, is that $75 per person
thousand.
Or $75,000 per household?
Household.
Per household.
Okay, I'm making this... my family's making $75,000, and I have to make a decision. I'm really excited about taking this bigger job and making an extra $25,000. And then I assume you say to them, well, is your house paid for? Well, how much is your rent, et cetera? Is the moral of the story that people should take your research and live according to it? Or what are you supposed to do with this information?
So the real question for us is, if you're going to make $25,000 more, what are you going to do with the $25,000 more? If you're going to move to an even bigger house and have more debt on the new house,
don't do it.
Don't do it. If you're going to move to a house that's much further away from your place of work, so you're spending 2 hours commuting every day, don't do it. You might think $25,000, that's going to be great. You just ruined your life. You spent so much time now wasted. Not only is commuting horrible, you're not with your family, you're grumpy when you get home. And we don't tend to think about the decisions in those terms. We just think $75,000, $100,000, no-brainer, let's take
the money. Is anybody living this? I mean, you mentioned a minute ago, despite the survey that I mentioned to you, that essentially people say, I want to be with the kids, and on their way to work, they say, I want to be with the kids. Most people are not living this ethos, are they? They intellectualize it, but then they go and do the same things. We've always done more is better, right?
Absolutely, and I think one of the key reasons for that is we like things that we can count. So if I want to know, am I doing better than I was last year? Or even more, am I doing better than the guy down the street? The easiest way for me to figure that out is, well, do I have more money? Do I have a bigger house? If I do, I must be doing better than last year. And we don't have a scale for, am I doing a good job with my kids? It's hard to say, I used to be a 6 on some scale and now I'm a 9. Because we don't have that, we tend to default to the things we can count, like money, and then we're in a trap of trying to get more and more.
I wonder if it's different now, because you do know people like of my parents' generation, they bought the house, they lived in it their whole life, you know, and they made more money, I presume, but they didn't move to the bigger house, and then when they sold the house, you know, they had money for their retirement and stuff like that, or they just never sold the house. I think you see a lot more of that bigger house thing now, don't you?
I think there is certainly. So average house size has definitely increased in the United States, and the frequency of upgrade has increased for sure, in part simply because mobility has increased in general. So you're bouncing from job to job, and so you want to get a better place everywhere you go. We see in our research and in other people's research that actually one of the worst things you can do with your money is upgrade your house.
Really?
If you get
How about putting in a new kitchen? I just did that a while ago.
I'm sorry, it was probably a mistake.
Oh no!
Too late now. Michael Norton, when the dean of the Harvard Business School says, "How much do you want in a salary increase this year?" What's your answer?
So what? It's a great question.
As he laughs nervously,
one of the things that we always say is, many people will say these phrases like, "You know, money can't buy you happiness."
Mm-hmm.
Often we have a friend who does yoga, who's actually extremely wealthy usually, and they say these phrases too. It's very irritating to hear.
Very irritating.
And then you can ask them, you know, hey, have you ever turned down a raise? And they, no, silence. And of course, no one has ever turned down a raise. It's never bad to have more money.
It's what you do with it.
What you do with it.
We only have a minute left. The book that's out today, Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending, what's it about? Same deal or is it something else?
So we try to say basically, here's how we usually spend our money. It's not that great for our happiness. And here's a bunch of different ways that you can change the way you spend your money. Buying experiences is one. Giving it away is one. We talked about underindulging. Taking a break from things can be great as well.
If you had to rate yourself on a scale of 1 to 100 about living what you preach, where would you rate yourself? Be honest.
where would my friends rate me or where would I rate myself?
Where would your friends rate you? That's actually a far better question.
I think I'm pretty high on the scale, actually.
You are? So on the good end of the scale.
On the good end of the scale.
You mean the happy end of the scale?
But living his philosophy. And
well, are you happy, Michael?
I am a pretty happy guy.
Good.
And I try to live pretty modestly, actually, even though Harvard professors are seen as very fancy individuals. So
are you living in a basement apartment somewhere? Do you have,
I hope
do you have
so.
A nice kitchen?
I have not a great kitchen,
oh, okay.
To be honest, which my girlfriend is not too pleased with.
Yeah. He was going to upgrade, but then he said, no, I don't think so.
Michael Norton is a professor at Harvard Business School. His book is Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Up next, writer Joyce Maynard joins us to talk about her book Labor Day and the story behind adapting it to the big screen. That conversation is next on Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Yes, history does repeat itself, and so do we. Today, we're replaying a collection of author interviews we've had over the past years. We wrap up today's show with writer Joyce Maynard. Her book, Labor Day, was adapted to the big screen. The film was released in January. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. It's probably fair to say that everyone who's heard of Joyce Maynard knows that we're having a nine-month affair with writer J.D. Salinger, but it's probably also fair to say that anyone who has read Joyce Maynard has a good sense of who she is. Joyce Maynard wrote her first memoir looking back when she was 19. 25 years later, she wrote her second, At Home in the World. In between and beyond, she's written several novels. Her latest one is entitled After Her. But today we're talking about her 2009 book. It's called Labor Day. Director Jason Reitman has adapted it to the big screen.
Who are police looking for? Frank Chambers, an inmate at Stinchfield Prison serving 18 years for murder.
I'd be grateful if you let me stay till nightfall.
Isn't it against the law to hide a fugitive?
If someone were to come by, it would need to look like I kidnapped you.
How do I know you won't hurt us? I'm stronger than you think.
I've never intentionally hurt anyone in my life.
What happened?
Just know that there's more to this story than you'll see in that paper there. You won't be needing that any longer. When you have to say I tied you up, you won't be lying.
Labor Day, the movie, opens nationwide on January 31st. The film was shot locally in Massachusetts, primarily in Shelburne Falls and Acton. It stars Josh Brolin, Tobey Maguire, and Kate Winslet. In fact, Joyce is calling this the Kate Winslet is unavailable to her. We're actually quite glad she is, because we're thrilled to meet you, Joyce Maynard. Welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Who would have thought that she'd get her big glamour moment a month after her 60th birthday?
Exactly.
Hers being yours, we're Mine. Talking
it's
about.
Wonderful.
Yes, happy birthday.
I've been walking the red carpet this year.
It's wonderful. And
I like to feel I'm an inspiration to, I'll call us midlife women.
You
everywhere.
Are. You are. As I said before we went on the air, I'm a big groupie. I've been a Joyce Maynard fan for years and years and years. And the clip from the movie sounds very sexy.
By the way, let me
This movie has the sexiest pie
Josh,
scene ever.
I want to talk about that. And I just want to say before we start,
what?
I am not a 60-year-old woman. And I am a big fan of yours. So let's get that on the record.
When this movie was previewed at the Telluride Film Festival, Jim, I ran into Michael Moore, who I know slightly. And he said, you wouldn't believe the men's room in there. They're all sniffling after seeing the movie.
Well, I mean,
I love to make the men cry.
Josh Brolin is a fine specimen of an actor. He's a very handsome guy. Escape Con.
And fine baker. That is a little known fact about
him. Well, you taught him how to bake a pie, correct? But before we get to the pie, tell us basically, what is Labor Day? What's the movie? Tell us about it.
The story, Labor Day tells the story of a love affair that ensues, that takes place over the course of a long, hot Labor Day weekend. Ooh. In a small New Hampshire town, as seen through the eyes of the 13-year-old son of the woman who's fallen in love. And the man she falls in love with is a convict on the run who gets her to take him home. And they're holed up in this house over this steamy weekend. And we see their love affair through the boy's eyes. And also 25 years later, after he's looking back on this weekend that had cataclysmic implications for all
of us. I've read you, Joyce, so you love the film. And how intimately involved were you in the script, in picking the players? And
officially, there's no involvement. And you know what? The last thing a director wants is to have the writer standing over his or her shoulder saying, well, I think this should change. You have to be prepared to let your work go.
But aren't you in agony waiting to see what the...
Of course, of course. And Jason Reitman, although he had no requirement to do this, was constantly showing me, checking in with me. I read the screenplay and I loved he adapted the novel, and it's a very true adaptation to the spirit of the book. Of course, people should still read the book. We all know that the book is the best thing.
Well, there's something particular about the book that people want to read it in the audio fashion or hear it in the audio fashion. Tell us about what's going on with the book when you hear it.
When you hear the book, I don't know. You have to tell
me your son.
Oh, my
reads
son,
it.
The audiobook. Oh.
We don't need Joyce for this interview. We can answer the
questions. The audiobook of Labor Day.
is read by your son.
Is read by my son, Wilson Bethel,
yes.
who's on a show called Heart of Dixie.
Okay.
On Heart of Dixie, he has an Alabama accent, but he's a New Hampshire boy.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't want to brush off this agony thing. You had an earlier book, To Die For, also made into a movie.
Yeah.
What is that when you first get the script from the director and you get to see for the first time what they have done to what you labored over?
You know,
What's that like?
This is untypical, I have to say, Jim, but I've been lucky twice. Buck Henry adapted To Die For. And so twice I've really had a wonderful film made of my novel. And
Pamela Smart.
I like to think it's because I write really good stories.
You do.
And they're stories that are very, I think they're, you know, there's a lot that happens in them. It's always about character for me, and these are really interesting, complex characters. But big things happen. I'm twice happy. I've written 8 novels and only 2 have been made for films, but my life's not over yet.
Well, if people forget the dreaded local angle, To Die For is based on the Pamela Smart murder trial. And Pamela Smart, of course, was not supposed to call her a teacher because she was some kind of audiovisual specialist or something
right.
like that.
You were there every day, were you not?
She had an aspiration to be you, basically.
That's right. And she paid her 15-year-old boyfriend to shoot her husband in the head.
Well, she paid him in an unusual fashion.
She did.
Or maybe a classic fashion.
They had a torrid affair.
Yes.
And who played Pamela Smart in the movie?
Nicole Kidman.
It was great.
In what I consider still her best role.
It was very funny.
I played her lawyer. You might not know that. I'm in that movie, as I am in Labor Day. But really, I was a little disappointed with my cameo. My real appearance in Labor Day is in the form of the pie, which is totally my pie.
Okay, you've mentioned the pie 3 times now, so let's get to it. Everybody is talking about the fact that you taught Josh Brolin how to do the pie thing, and now we know that after you taught him, he made a pie every single day during production to the point where there was a peach shortage in Concord, Mass. Did you know that?
I did not know that, but I do know that people were actually pushing the pies away. And he makes a fine pie, but it's almost too good, you know?
So what's with you and pies?
You know, my pie story starts 25 years ago. Well, it starts 60 years ago when I was born. I am the daughter of a spectacular pie maker. And I never needed to make pie because my mother always made pie. And then my mother was dying of cancer. And I went to take care of her. And I made pie every day of that summer for her and her friends. And I didn't know I knew how to make her pie, but I had breathed it in. And her friends would take me aside and say, we're going to miss your mother, but we're going to miss her pie. Would you give us the recipe? And I said to them what I have been saying for the 25 years since. It's not about the recipe. The recipe is always the same. It's about how you handle the dough, how you make it. We're speaking of crust here, of course, the big issue for people.
It's really hard.
And the only way to learn is at the elbow of somebody who knows how to do it. So I have probably taught at this point a few thousand people how to make pie. I only do it for love. I do it if there's some candidate I believe in or an earthquake's happened in Haiti. I open up my doors and charge a little money and teach people how to make pie. So when I was writing Labor Day, and I was thinking about this character of Frank, the escaped convict, who could seem like a really bad guy, and we want to see who he truly is. A neighbor shows up that weekend and gives Adele, the mother, who's now Kate Winslet in my mind, a bucket of overripe peaches, and she's about to throw them out. And Frank, the convict, now Josh Brolin, says, "Wait a second. I'll tell you. I have a better idea." And he proceeds to make a pie. So Josh
and
had...
And teach them, right?
And
teach
them.
Winslet and the kid.
So he had to have not just make a pie. He had to have command of that pie. And he had to be... To really get the sense of just he owned that pie. And he did. He did. And his pie does not look like a Martha Stewart. It was actually kind of funny, Marjorie and Jim, but I feel like, you know, we have this pie.
We bonded.
Yes. They had on set this high-level, famous movie food person who was wearing her white chef coat, which is not me. And she was looking a little appalled at my methods. I don't measure. I scoop the Crisco with one hand and the sugar with the other. And I'm flour is flying, dough is flying, and apple peels are going over my shoulder. I was much influenced by things that happened in the WGBH studio years ago.
Is that so?
Yes.
Oh. What happened in the WGBH
studio? Well, the Julia Child method.
Oh, Julia Child. Okay, all right.
Can you do a Julia Child imitation? I bet you can, Joyce.
My son could. My son can be anybody. My son, you know, this is actually, well, it's not getting off track because really at the core of this story is a question that was always much on my mind. What is it like for your children to watch you conducting a love affair with somebody who isn't their parent, if you're a single
parent. I know.
And my children did grow up with that sometimes. I was a single parent for most of their growing up years. My son Will, this came to me because my son Will, the one who's the actor, is terrifyingly good at doing imitations. He could be Julia Child. And one day he called me up and he was about 10 years old, and he was at his dad's house, and he called me up, and he said in a voice that was unrecognizable, "So, what are you wearing?"
Wait a minute. This was when you were at home?
I was at home. I could have been wearing something that I wouldn't have wanted him to know. But I knew that I didn't know anybody who would be asking that question, unfortunately. And then I knew Will, so that I did realize, oh my gosh, that is my son, just in time.
That's the voice of Joyce Mayer,
but in
by
fact,
the way.
That is an element of Labor Day. We are seeing a young boy just entering his own sexuality, observing in a discomforting way the sexuality of his mother, but also yearning for a father in his life.
So how autobiographical is Adele?
Not at all. I mean, I was a single parent, a single mother in a small New Hampshire town. I even drove the car that Kate, I never told Jason this, but that was, he gave Kate Winslet the car I used to drive, an enormous boat of a Ford Country Squire wagon with wood paneling. But I'm not that agoraphobic woman who just, you know, can barely go out.
Yeah.
And she does go out. The way she meets the convict is that her son has outgrown his pants, and it's back to school coming up after Labor Day weekend. So she takes him shopping for new school pants, and it is at the Price Mart store that this man comes staggering up with blood, you know, coming down his head and says, "Would you take me home?" And she does.
Well, you know, lots of us might be tempted if we saw Josh Brolin in the parking lot to say, throw my caution to the wind with the blood coming down, because he is one very handsome man. What was it like to be up close and personal with two people, that Josh Brolin and whose mother-in-law is Barbara Streisand?
Yes. Actually, years ago, Barbara Streisand was going to play me in a movie, which was something he didn't know, because I think that was before his dad's time. I was an anti-nuclear organizer in New Hampshire in the 80s, and Barbara Streisand read a story that I'd written about campaigning against the first in the nation high-level nuclear waste dump coming to New Hampshire, and she bought the rights to my story. Never played me, unfortunately. She never played a New Hampshire housewife.
Are they close? Do you have any idea?
I don't really know. We
did. He is married to Diane Lane.
I
know that.
I've had a certain experience in my own life of being endlessly identified with some famous person while I've been conducting my own life and doing my own things. And so I don't fault you, Jim, but it's happened every day of the last 41 years. So the last person I would ever ask Josh Brolin about would be Barbara Streisand.
Well, speaking of that, have you ever done an interview? Thank you for not folding me.
No, I never.
I mean, you just wrote about this a couple of months ago yourself when the documentary came out, the Salinger documentary. Done an interview where Salinger's name has not arisen?
Well, never. But you wrote a great, brilliant piece in the New York Times after the documentary about Salinger came out. And I think that everybody, particularly women, can identify this, where you had this line in there that said, it is the quiet, and of course, if people don't know this, Salinger was picking up, for lack of a better word, very young women to carry on with. And you were 18, as you put out in your story.
I was hardly the only one.
One of them was 14, and there were at least a dozen of these women. It's really kind of creepy, in my view anyway. And you write about the quiet acceptance, apparently alive and well in our culture, of the notion that genius justifies cruel or abusive treatment of those who serve the artist, Salinger, and his art. And you quote this film critic as saying, "He liked pretty girls." The implication being, what's the fuss?
Yes.
He did get a free pass for much of his life and even post his life on being a guy 50, 60, 70 years old going after very, very young women.
Well, yes. The part that personally has been wounding to me is that, and I'm over it, it's okay, but that for so many years I was identified in one way as, you know, the ex-girlfriend,
yes,
of the important man. And meanwhile, I've written 13 books, actually quite a few more than he ever did.
More than he has, that's right.
So for me, that this film, which has absolutely no relationship to Salinger, is a wonderful film, and it's hardly the only thing I've done in the last 41 years, is the best way that I know to counter it.
Why do you say no relationship to Salinger?
Because there's only one book of the 13 in which I address
mentioned
what that,
okay,
story meant, and that is At Home in the World, a book that I always say, if people want to know what happened and if people take issue with me, I will ask them, have you read that book?
And you were 19 when you wrote that book.
No, we're not speaking of that book. We're speaking of the book I wrote 25 years later.
Oh, I'm sorry.
For
forgive
25
me.
Years, I said nothing of him. I subscribe to this belief that many people still do, that, you know, you do not speak of the great man because he said not to do that. And then I wrote the real memoir, the one that is the story of my life, not the story of Salinger, the story of me, but he's in it. It was almost universally condemned. Time magazine said the one good thing about this book is we'll never have to hear from Joyce Maynard again.
Do you think it's any different now, 2013, that attitude about the genius male artist, whatever he does in his private life, even if it's really kind of creepy, is
okay? Or she.
Or she. That's,
yes,
true. I mean, or are we a little bit more critical of those kinds of things?
I'm the mother of three adult children who are now 29, 31, and 35. And I see a kind of open-mindedness in them that did not exist in my generation, certainly. I mean,
okay,
they don't subscribe to all these sort of old ideas. It's very refreshing, actually.
Okay, so this is an audio medium, unfortunately. Give us, before you go, give people who probably are wildly interested in the pie thing, give us a couple of tips for the novice,
okay,
pie baker.
Well, I will tell those people, since we are limited by audio, that I have actually, because this comes up a lot, I have made an online video that they can see.
Ah, fantastic.
And it's on curious.com,
okay,
a wonderful platform. If they're new to Curious, they won't even have to pay anything. It's normally like 99 cents. It's like an iTunes download. And it is a pie lesson that will filmed in my kitchen, and by the time you're done with that lesson, you too will make a great pie. But for those who don't own a laptop, perhaps,
or can't wait.
Can't wait. I will say, there needs to be less water than you think. Most pies, including the sort of those beautiful Martha Stewart pies, are too smooth, too perfect. My pie looks like it was made by a convict on the run. It is that flaky. And you need to just barely, my mother always said, never overhandle the dough. You just touch it the least you can. Butter is better for flavor. Crisco is better for flakiness. So, of course, I use both. I measure nothing, but I technically the recipe is what all the recipes are. But I would say joie de vivre. You cannot over-worry your pie crust. You have to do it with a certain freedom and an attitude that, you know, a forgiving attitude.
Look at the look on Marjorie's face, Joyce Maynard, as you were describing.
I don't know how to make
a pie. You are 15 minutes away from knowing.
Okay. I think that's true.
Yes.
Okay, and if people want to know about your work, what you're doing, where they can hear you do readings.
I have a website.
What is your website? You teach writing as well.
Yes, I do. I'm heading off to Guatemala. Once a year,
what
I
a
go
wonderful
to a little
place.
Mayan village on the shores of Lake Atitlan, looking out over the volcanoes, and help people tell the story of their life. Because I paid a big price for telling the story of mine, and I would never, never undo that. So I love to facilitate other people of all levels. But joycemaynard.com, just
That's
my name.
That's very easy. We can all remember that.
Joyce, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much for your time.
And, you know, I mentioned this when you first came in, but it's a great collection of columns, which is in a book, which you can probably still get on Amazon.
You can download
Amazon.
It.
Amazon.com, yeah. Domestic Affairs, about just being a mom with kids, the married life when your kids are little. It was a great...
Do you know, I have to tell you, just
what?
As a historical
what?
Fact, I wrote that column for 8 years, but 7 years into that column, my marriage ended. And, of course, what could I do? I had to say that happened. Of the 50 papers that ran that column, 40 dropped it and said, this was not ancient history. This is 1989. And they said I was no longer equipped to write about family life. And in some ways, you know, I'm bringing this all back to Labor Day. I wanted to honor the family life of a single parent, that too is family life. That too is a family.
We were speaking with writer and author Joyce Maynard. Her book, Labor Day, was recently adapted to the big screen and on the small screen. If you want to see a video of Joyce Maynard making pie, she made one right here at WGBH. Go to WGBHnews.org to see that. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Our show is a production of WGBH. Boston Public Radio's our production crew includes Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, Devin Karambalis. Our engineers are John Parker and Alan Mattis. Our show is a production of WGBH.